Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
And I'm ABC's Deputy Political Director Mary Alice Parks.
And we're here in Detroit, Michigan, the site of the second series of presidential debates. We're here right outside the beautiful Fox Theater in the spin room where the candidates all cycled through a couple hours ago, and they'll be back in a few hours for night two. Mary Alice, it's one of those debates where what we got was kind of what we thought we'd get. We knew that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren would be center stage, and we knew there was a whole lot of red and purple state governors and senators and mayors surrounding them, and it was, in a sense, revenge of the moderates. You had a whole bunch of folks making a warning about what it meant to be going too far left in 2019, 2020.
These big progressive ideas like free college or government-run health care took punches from all sides. But in the end, I thought that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, when the dust settled, were left standing. They benefited from getting to fight the whole night on their turf. They took punches, but they got to defend their ideas and revert back to their talking points over and over again. And I was just really impressed by Elizabeth Warren. The more I thought about it this morning, she is incredible at taking very complicated economic ideas and breaking them down into simple policy. But still, like you said, the moderates on the wings of her tried to make not only arguments about the policy she was proposing, but the politics and whether her policies would just be a bridge too far in a general election.
And we're going to check in a little bit later in the show with Terry McAuliffe, the former governor of Virginia, former chairman of the DNC, and I think a member of the party's establishment wing going back through the Clinton years and the Obama years and beyond, his take on what Joe Biden needs to do, particularly on night two. But I do think it was stark to hear people from states like Ohio and Minnesota and Colorado and Montana and Texas and Indiana say, look, you senators from Massachusetts and Vermont, this is how America views these things. And when we're having the conversations about health care for all via Medicare for all, when you're having a conversation about the Green New Deal, when you're telling undocumented immigrants that you can get health care and that will decriminalize the very border crossings, you are not connecting with voters the way they live their lives.
Right. Governor Steve Bullock from Montana, who won in a state where President Trump won by 20 points, made his debut. He hadn't qualified for the first debate, but qualified for the debate stage here in Detroit. And he had a pretty simple way of explaining his concern over this Medicare for All idea that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are proposing.
You know, it took us decades and false starts to get the Affordable Care Act. So let's actually build on it. A public option allowing anyone to buy in.
So he's making the argument that Democrats should focus on what they already have. They feel like they have a step up over Republicans in terms of this health care debate, and that they're, one, proposing policies that he doesn't agree with, but also that they're risking giving up this electoral advantage they have if they're all of a sudden in favor of repealing a law that's gotten increasingly popular.
And it wasn't just Governor Bullock, and it wasn't just health care. I was struck when Governor Hickenlooper, a two-term governor of Colorado, a purple state, trending toward the Democrats. Democrats have been doing fairly well in Colorado recently, but it hasn't always been that way. Warned that when you start talking about Medicare for All, when you start talking about the Green New Deal, you could be guaranteeing a re-election for President Trump.
I'm saying the policies of this notion that you're going to take private insurance away from 180 million Americans, who many of them don't want to give it. Many of them do want to get rid of it, but some don't. Many don't. Or you're going to, the Green New Deal, make sure that every American is guaranteed a government job if they want. That is a disaster at the ballot box. You might as well FedEx the election to Donald Trump.
So that, to me, is ringing the alarm bell. That's saying from the moderate wing of the party, which, you know, these are not conservative Democrats, right? These are progressives in their own way, and they would define themselves as progressives. They're saying that this party is in real danger if it follows the Warren Sanders path, real danger of putting itself out of existence at the presidential level.
Switching back to, we're going back and forth now ourselves between the policy and the politics, but switching back to the policy idea, I was struck there when you said these aren't conservative Democrats. It is worth taking a moment to look at just how far left the conversation on healthcare has gone. 8-10 years ago, President Obama wasn't able to put in place a public option, a government run health insurance program that people could buy into. That was seen as just too much to be palpable for a general election, for Congress. And now that's the conservative, more moderate stance on these debate stages. That's what all these governors and again, even more moderate members of the House are saying is the given. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, if you just look at the pure policy of it, And obviously, there's a lot of practical considerations that went into this, but they're all essentially to the left of Barack Obama on health care. They want to do more for health care than Obamacare did, which should put Biden in an interesting position again tonight. John Delaney had a pretty big night. He was positioned directly against Senator Sanders right to start it off. I thought his argument, this is a guy from Maryland, but with a business background as opposed to some of the others on that stage, who again just said, look, we just can't offer, we can't overpromise voters and expect to win.
With bad policies like Medicare for all, free everything, and impossible promises that'll turn off independent voters and get Trump reelected.
And I think that was the theme of the night, Mary Alice, that the Democrats, you heard it from Amy Klobuchar as well, Democrats have to be careful that they can actually deliver on these promises and that they're promises that voters actually want.
And then Senator Elizabeth Warren had a big applause line with her rebuttal. She basically said that what's the point of running it all?
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
And so there with Elizabeth Warren, you have her argument about the politics of her ideas. Not only do I think her and Bernie Sanders sort of agree on these sweeping policy proposals, they think it's smart politics. They think that if you settle for something that feels a little bit safer and a little more moderate, you end up with a Hillary Clinton problem, and that the way to beat President Trump, in their view, is to energize the base and get young people excited about something new.
And Bernie Sanders made that argument directly. He made the point that he's winning in polling in a bunch of battleground states, including right here in Michigan, where he won the primary against Hillary Clinton, and that that going big, going bold, is really what the Democrats need.
We have got to take on Trump's racism, his sexism, xenophobia, and come together in an unprecedented grassroots movement to not only defeat Trump, but to transform our economy and our government.
So, yeah, it's a classic heart versus head argument. The Democratic Party continues to be pretty deeply split on matters of policy as well as politics. And I think there's just a genuine disagreement about what the right politics are. I think they all, you know, these debates tend to emphasize and overemphasize what the policy disagreements are. They all want to expand healthcare. Mm-hmm. They all want to go further. And I think there was some frustration.
Climate change.
Right. There's unanimity on those things. So these relatively small policy differences get blown up to be big existential questions. I was struck by Mayor Pete Buttigieg, I think, made a salient point that you know, Democrats really can't worry about what Trump says because he's going to say it anyway.
And he also had a good line when he said, we can't do any of this stuff if we don't win.
If we embrace a far-left agenda, they're going to say we're a bunch of crazy socialists. If we embrace a conservative agenda, you know what they're going to do? They're going to say we're a bunch of crazy socialists.
So, Mary Alice, in addition to Mayor Pete, Beto O'Rourke was in the spotlight last night. A lot of people were saying he needed to have a kind of big, strong breakout performance. I didn't see it from him. I don't know your thoughts on this. He's going to be fine. He's going to qualify for the next debate, which most of the candidates on the stage aren't guaranteed of. But I didn't see him breaking out in a big way.
No, I didn't think that Beto O'Rourke or Mayor Pete sort of stole the limelight. But of the two of them, I thought that Mayor Pete Buttigieg at least was able to look a little bit above the fray. When he did talk, he seemed to do a good job pivoting the conversation back to him versus the president or Democrats versus the president, which made him look kind of like above the infighting. I agree. Beto O'Rourke, I don't think, had the night that he was hoping to have.
Let's talk about those who did have the night that they were hoping to have. We mentioned Bullock. He didn't make the cut the first time. He was there this time. He brought his cowboy boots on stage. Obviously a bit of a different look and a different flavor than the other candidates. How did he fare?
He made a solid introduction to the country. They didn't know him before. It was his first time on a debate stage. He got to separate himself as someone that doesn't agree with those progressives in the center of the stage. And there's something appealing about governors. We're going to talk to another one in just a little bit. Governors get to say that they've actually done things, and that will appeal to a lot of voters.
Let's talk about Marianne Williamson, because you can't not. And I think a lot of people have seen the Google statistics, the Google trends on this, that mm-hmm. in 49 out of 50 states, other than Steve Bullock's Montana, every state in the union, she was the most Googled about candidate, the rising search terms during the debate itself. A lot of people are curious about this spiritual guru, Oprah's self-help buddy, best-selling author, Marianne Williamson.
People don't know her on the national political stage, and I think that's probably her greatest appeal. We know that voters are interested in an outsider. There is something really powerful about getting to sound like you're not the one from Washington. You don't use Washington speak.
If you think any of this wonkiness is going to deal with this dark psychic force of the collectivized hatred that this president is bringing up in this country, then I'm afraid that the Democrats are going to see some very dark days.
And it's true, she doesn't sound like a politician. When she talks about these issues, she sounds like a human, someone that's incredibly thoughtful, but thinks about things really differently than some of the senators and governors on stage. I thought she had a really powerful moment when she defended her plan for reparations. She sounded not only pretty informed, but really personal and heartfelt talking about it. It came across really, really well in the room.
Yeah, and look, she needs a polling bump. She needs a fundraising bump. We caught up with her right after the debate, and she talked about the potentially mattering. And as we talked about, Mary Alice, a lot of the folks that have been on the stage, that are on the stage this week, may never appear on another Democratic debate stage. The qualifications for the next debate in September double, basically, in terms of the polling threshold and the fundraising numbers. 2% is the number you need in four different polls. That will be ABC's debate in a couple of months. And we are pretty much guaranteed a significantly smaller field than the one we've seen so far, which I think it probably colored some of the attack lines of Tuesday night, and it injects some urgency into Wednesday as well.
Oh, yeah, no question. The candidates would like to think that this is a long primary, but it's really not for many of them. The Democratic Party is making sure that some of them won't qualify. They are rushing the timeline and making sure that if candidates don't start showing that they are performing in the polls, they have to bow out.
And talking about night two, I couldn't believe this in real time, Mary Alice. I had to go back and search the transcript two different times. The words Joe Biden did not come up at all in night one, which is odd in that he is the front runner. He's the polling front runner, up double digits in a range of polls. We know that he has been criticized from a whole range of folks, including some that have already been on a debate stage now. That will obviously change when Joe Biden is the first candidate to speak tonight, I would presume. But what did it say to you that the candidates found other ways to differentiate themselves? And what does it mean for Biden's strategy tonight that it was set up in this way?
There's always a risk that if you talk about the presumed front runner, you elevate them even more. So I think some of the candidates were probably leery about doing that. It's also just the dynamics of the first night. The two progressive powerhouses in the middle of the stage, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, don't benefit a lot from talking about him. They want to make their own case. They're also polling pretty well, and they have a strong following. And the others on the wings sound a lot like Joe Biden. They would just like to take his support. They'd like to chip away at the people that think like him, that they hope think like they do. So no one really benefited last night from bringing it up. But like you said, I think that with him the center going forward for night two, it, basically the whole conversation is going to revolve around him.
Literally, folks, it's conversation, as Biden might say. Literally, folks, he is sandwiched by some of the challenges that he might face as a candidate. To have an African-American senator on either side of him, yeah, on that stage, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, both of whom have been critical of the vice president's record on race going back. I think there's going to be some backlash potentially if you go too far back in history for these candidates. But Biden has shown real vulnerabilities on this. His team acknowledging publicly and privately he didn't have the debate that he hoped to have last time. There's a lot riding on him showing his supporters, the core group of supporters that are tuned in, that he gets that message.
And gets it in this moment where we've seen the president make just unbelievable, unprecedented, racially divisive attacks and double down on a campaign strategy that's about racial divisions in this country. You know, the president attacking sitting members of Congress who are African-American, and Biden's going to have to show that he can play in that space. Or does it end up looking like the two African-American candidates are better equipped for this moment?
Yeah, and it is quite a moment for the vice president and for the Democratic Party as night two awaits. When we come back after the break, we are going to be joined by the man who was governor of Virginia when Charlottesville happened. Speaking of this big issue, these big issues around race, Terry McAuliffe, who's written a new book called Beyond Charlottesville. Stick with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. We are joined here in Detroit in the spin room of the Democratic debate by Terry McAuliffe, the former governor of Virginia and the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, a longtime participant and observer of national politics, someone who thought about running for president initially. Was there any part of you, governor, that felt like, man, I wish I was up there last night, or wish I had one more shot at this?
Listen, I really wanted to run for governor. I thought we had a great message.
Yeah.
Run for president. Southern governor, took a record deficit, turned it into a huge surplus, record jobs, very progressive. But, We had issues at home in Virginia, as you know. We got our house and Senate up this year. You got to go where you actually can make the biggest difference in life. So I've gone back. I think I've done 57 events in the last 6 weeks. I'm campaigning for everybody. So I'm happy to be back in Virginia. But sure, you know, sometimes when a question, you just sit there, oh, I would have answered it this way, you know. It's just natural.
Well, give us an example.
I'm young, though, Rick. Come on.
I know. Oh, yes.
I'm young.
We're going to start it right now. Terry McAuliffe, 24, 28. Let's keep
it
going.
That's the plan. I heard the beginning of your stump speech right there.
There you go. Exactly.
So give us an example of that. We saw a pretty spirited debate last night about health care, about electability, about what it means to be a Democrat in 2020. Which side of the argument do you come down on? Do you feel like, is it the go bold or go home idea, or the party needs to recalibrate to reach voters like those right here in Michigan that feel left behind by the party?
Well, I come from what I call the pragmatic realism. Let's talk about things we actually can get done that will help people's lives. I have been concerned in the debates. You know, I don't hear any discussion of K-12 education, no real discussion of workforce development, no discussion of infrastructure, no discussion of cybersecurity. You know, people are sitting at home. They have challenges. You know, they're going to the pharmacy. Their prescription drug prices are through the roof. And nobody's asked a question like, I'm a family of four. Tell me exactly how you're going to lower my prescription drugs. So, you know, we spent a lot of time on Medicare for All. I thought Tim Ryan raised a very important point to those 600,000 union workers who gave up compensation to get health care. And now you're telling me that the government's going to come in and run it for me. So, I mean, these are valid issues that we have to have a discussion about. But, you know, let's talk about what people are concerned about at home. And we spent a lot of time in the last debate on immigration and people coming in and not being charged with a crime and they're going to get health care. But people are sitting home and we've got to make sure we take care of everybody. But people are sitting home, wait a minute, when are you going to talk to me? You know, we've got issues. We've got homeless issues in our cities. We've got high prescription drug costs. When are you going to talk about the things that I go to bed worrying about every single day?
Colorado's Governor John Hickenlooper said that ideas like Medicare for All or the Green New Deal would FedEx the election back to Donald Trump. Do you buy that? Is Medicare for All just a bridge too far for a general election audience?
And here's my point on Medicare for All. We've got 96% of Americans are actually covered with health coverage. The issue on health care is not that remaining 4%. We want to morally make sure everybody's covered. The issue is people are being stressed at home by the cost of health care. They go to a hospital. All of a sudden, they get home. Oh, my goodness. I got an out-of-network bill for $2,000 from an anesthesiologist. So while we're over here talking about these shiny objects and all laudable goals, we are not addressing the issue. So, John Hickam, and listen, I think governors
isn't
would...
Isn't that the idea that if everyone had government health insurance, it wouldn't... I mean, isn't that the argument that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were making, that if everyone had government insurance, out-of-network issues would go away?
That's the argument. Is it practical and can it happen? I think will be the debate. There is a huge challenge. 150 million people have insurance, private insurers. They would lose that. And I think that needs to be flushed out in fairness. But John is a governor. Bullock is a governor. I was a governor. I think governors would be great presidents only because you're CEOs. You balance budgets, you create jobs, you build roads, you clean them. I love members of the House and Senate, but they get to do a lot of talking. As governor, you don't talk. So when John Hickenlooper was talking about that, remember, we run the health care in our states. So what happens up in Washington, we've got to implement it at the state level. And we've got a pretty good handle of the best way for us to deal with these health care issues. The problem is Trump came in. And Trump, I mean, listen, if Trump had come in and done infrastructure, fixed health care, and stayed off his crazy tweeting and all the nutty stuff he does, with the economy going, he'd be in a much better position. But he didn't do any of that. But what he did on health care brought uncertainty to the market. It has really, I've seen some policy premiums go up 62% in Virginia.
Do you want to endorse one of those governors right now?
I've been on TV very vocal saying that our governors, it's hard for a governor to be president, run for president. I'll tell you why. Number one, senators and House members transfer their money over.
Yeah.
We can't because it's non-federal money. Number two, we don't have the name ID. You get a Kavanaugh hearing or a Barr hearing or a Mueller hearing, a House and a senator, House member and senator, they're on TV in front of 20 million people. You weren't calling me up when I was governor saying, Governor, tell me about I-66 and the road improvement. It just wasn't sexy. You never talked to me about that. But that's a huge disadvantage.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end, the more debates, the more discussion, we'll see where we go.
So let's talk about Vice President Biden. I was shocked his name didn't even come up in debate night one. That's going to change, obviously, in night two. We saw his performance a couple of weeks ago. What does he have to do tonight to assuage some of the concerns around his candidacy?
So if I'm Biden and I'm watching that debate, I think he needs to be very careful. He needs to come out with his positive plans of what he wants to do. Can't necessarily go attack other programs because that didn't work well last night, as you well know. I think he needs to say, I understand where you're coming from on, you know, Medicare for all and the new Green Deal and other issues, but here's how I think the best way to get there, and here's the best way to do it for America that will benefit Americans the most. And listen, he's got to be strong. He's got to be tough. You know, the first debate was not his strongest. His benefit is that he has the best opportunity in the polling data to beat Donald Trump. Poll out in Ohio the other day, he beats him by 8 points. That will hold him up tremendously. He can't let any get any kinks in the armor. And if he doesn't have a good debate, they say, well, goodness, how can you handle Donald Trump if you can't handle, you know, these candidates on the debate stage? So I think he needs to come out positive, strong plan, needs to defend himself. And, you know, he's the front runner. They're going to go after you. That's part of the business we're in.
And he needs to push back, you think, and show a little more.
I mean, you got to be honest. Toughness is a big piece of this business. You got to be tough. First of all, to be president of the United States, you deal with a lot of challenges. As I say with a governor, you're a CEO. You are going to be confronted with big, difficult decisions. I had Charlottesville. You have tornadoes, snowstorms. A president, a governor has to deal with these issues. Joe Biden has to go out there and show he's tough enough and he has the experience to handle these calamities that are going to come. They're going to affect every president.
Joe Biden opened his whole campaign focused on that episode in Charlottesville. He talked about it in his campaign video, really said that the president was letting the country down, sort of lacked the moral aptitude to run the country. Did you talk to Joe Biden about what happened in your state? And do you feel like Joe Biden is the best person to help heal some of these racial divisions that we're seeing right now?
I did talk to him ahead of time. I'd spent hours with Joe Biden before I made my final decision. And listen, I was the governor during Charlottesville. I'm the one who talked to Donald Trump that day, begged him to come out, and he needed to lead the nation. I told him we had 1,000 neo-Nazis and white supremacists screaming the most vile things against women, against African-Americans. I'm standing in the synagogue, and they're saying, we're going to burn you and burn that synagogue like we did in Auschwitz. I explained this to the president. They came from 35 states. They weren't Virginians. They came in to spew hatred. And I said, this is your opportunity, Mr. President. You know, Obama had Charleston, Clinton had Oklahoma City, Bush had 9/11. You don't have many opportunities as a president when something defining happens. And Donald Trump failed that day. He came out, delayed his press conference for 3 hours. I talk about it in the book. I don't know why. I think Bannon, Miller, somebody got to him and said, no, Mr. President, you are not going to attack neo-Nazis. He never mentioned neo-Nazis. He never mentioned white supremacists. And he said there were good people on both sides. Heather Heyer was killed that day. I lost 2 state troopers that day. They were killed defending, fighting for individual liberties and to stop this hate speech. So, and Joe Biden, I'm glad he did talk about it because what Trump and the insanity that he has done, I mean, Trump came out as a full-fledged racist in Charlottesville, no question. And now he's doubled down on Elijah Cummings and the squad, and he's trying to divide the country. And I'm glad Joe Biden's talking about it, and I hope the other candidates do, because the next challenge for the next president is to heal the country and to bring us back together.
How do you do that?
Well, first of all, you get rid of Trump. I mean, we can't deal every day with what
But beyond that, I mean, this is bigger than the president.
So I talk about it in the book, and my last chapter is how do we go forward? The one, you know, as bad as Charlottesville was, the benefit was that it ripped the scab off. Racism is alive and well in America. I think for far too long, people, white people, felt that, oh, we dealt with the issues. They don't, it's not comfortable to talk about racist issues. They're not. What Charlottesville did, ripped it off and showed the inequities that we have in school and housing, the inequities in healthcare. We have a racist criminal justice system in parts of our country. So what do? You get in, you deal with the root causes, inequities in school. Got to make sure everybody has a quality. You know, African-American children should not go to an inferior school with inferior facilities and not the same level of teachers. There are a lot of things we can do, But, you know, we've got to lean in. We got to fix the criminal justice system. I had a young man I pardoned my last day in office. He had five robberies. The total he stole was $530. Okay? No one was injured. He was a coke addict. His sentence in Virginia for $535, two life sentences plus 130 years. I could go chapter and verse. We got to end that type of, you know, this is remnant of Jim Crow.
You mentioned these sentencing laws, and it actually brings up another question to my mind, which has to do with the Clinton legacy. You're very close to the Clintons. Yeah. You work very closely with them at the DNC and for the campaigns. Are you concerned that a lot of the Clinton-era accomplishments, like the crime bill, for instance, welfare reform, they're almost curse words in the Democratic Party right now? What do you make of the Clinton legacy, and can it be restored in the context of this Democratic primary that's seeing the party move pretty far left?
Well, if you look at Bill Clinton's 8 years as president and all of the things that he accomplished in the country with the economy, and, you know, so many great things were done. I mean, I think he did leave office with the highest approval rating of any two-term president in the history of America. So voters, citizens, were happy with it. As we evolve in time and policies change, I mean, things that may have made sense or may not have made sense in the early 90s, Rick, are different today. But listen, you know, he had a spectacular 8 years, but nobody's going back and looking at the Clinton years, or really not going back looking at the Obama years. Folks want to go forward. And that's why I didn't like that one debate. I don't want to hear about busing 40 years ago. I don't. What are you doing for me today?
Do you think it's not relevant? I mean, to go back to positions on busing, for instance?
I don't think it's particularly helpful. You're not going to change something that happened 40 years ago. But what are you going to do for me today? We got issues. We got North Korea launching missiles again. I mean, we've got a debt that is just out of control. They're going to affect my five children. I mean, there are issues we need to talk about today going forward. And that's what these candidates really have to lean in on, and to relitigate the past and attack one another on. People want a leadership.
Before I let you go, any final thoughts or advice for Tom Perez? You've had his job. What should he do this fall?
Well, listen, I'm very happy the way these debates, as you probably all know, I started these debates when I was chairman of the DNC. We did not have DNC-sponsored debates.
Yeah.
Remember, we used to have hundreds of groups calling candidates saying, come. I said, no, we're going to do six debates. I'm going to televise them. And the reason I did it was to give all candidates, some candidates never got any exposure. You all got your little time up there, and you got an opportunity to make your point. But I would tell Tom Perez, keep on doing it. We're going to win this thing. We're going to come together. And I'd finally say, buy the book. It's out in the bookstores yesterday. Hold the book up,
Hold
Rick.
The book up, Beyond Charlottesville. There
I'm telling
is.
You. Boom. And the cover of Newsweek this week. Boom.
All right. Terry McAuliffe. Terry McAuliffe, author, former governor, former DNC chair.
Could be my second bestseller.
Is that right?
My mother rolling her grave. She would never have believed it.
What a party. It was
what
a really good book.
That was a good book.
I had a lot of fun with that one.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Governor. And you may be a presidential candidate again. We're going to launch.
Who knows? I'm young. Who knows? Never. You know, listen, I'd like to be Pope. I'd like to be Tom Brady's backup quarterback. Never rule anything out.
I love big dreaming. All right. Thank you, Governor.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
So, Mary Alice, I think you hear from Terry McAuliffe, who's known Vice President Biden a long time. Maybe some skepticism still around his candidacy, talking about how the governors may be better equipped, but an earnest desire to see him do better and to pull this together. I wonder if there's an anti-Biden force that seems to be gathering right now, a pretty scattered series of forces right now. Could it be that Biden is the beneficiary of a lot of these concerns that we heard on stage the first night? As you pointed out, these candidates were saying things that Biden may wish he was able to say that well.
Yeah, and look, the Democratic strategist that we talked to in Washington, Rick, will say that their first concern is beating President Trump, and there's still an earnest belief that Joe Biden is best equipped to do that he's a safe pick and can do that. But there's also a lot of anxiety about whether he has the stamina, the fortitude to make it through this whole primary and this whole general election. And we're hearing a lot of anxiety from folks, kind of, I would say, that more establishment part on Capitol Hill, people that have been around in Democratic politics for a long time, a real anxiety that if he doesn't have a strong performance this time, it could be really detrimental.
And the way you do it is show it. I mean, you have to be out there. We know that optics matter in this game. We saw it last week with Robert Mueller, who's a little bit younger than Joe Biden, actually, and younger than Bernie Sanders as well. He has to show that he is up for the fight in every way and pushing back. And that's tough when you're the front runner. It's tough in any position. Biden has been the first to admit that he was caught by surprise by some of the attacks he faced last time.
It's not always his style, but it can be. We've seen sort of fighter Vice President Joe Biden. So it'll be interesting to see which version of him kind of shows up.
All right. That does it for this edition of Powerhouse Politics. Our thanks to the whole team back in New York and Washington, Trevor Hastings, Angie Yak, Avery Miller. For Mary Alice Parks, that's it from Detroit. I'm Rick Klein. Thanks for listening.